Expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
When you contribute to KUCI, you give the gift of discovery. KUCI has provided non-commercial independent music and public affairs programming to the community since 1969, allowing young and old alike to discover new music, literature, art, and unique voices you just can't hear anywhere else. My name is Ghazal Hassan. I'm a 1993 graduate of UC Irvine, and in my time as a student, I had the distinct privilege of serving as general manager of KUCI and have continued to work in both radio and media as a writer and broadcaster since graduating. More importantly, though, the fondest memories of my college experience are related to my involvement with the station. So I urge you to call 949-824-5824 or log on to KUCI.org to make a contribution during this spring pledge drive so we can keep this cycle of discovery going at 88.9 FM. Thank you all for your listenership and for your support.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Hello, hello. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I am your host, DJ Broca, welcoming you to Pills, easy-to-swallow stories in medicine. If you've been listening to KUCI this week, as you know, we're in our second week of the spring fun drive, and possibly the only fun drive if we can raise our goal of $10,000. So, if you have a chance, and, you know, you can do this within by Friday, May 12th, but please do it as soon as you can. Call in to 949-824-KUCI and make your pledge. You can pledge anything and everything. We accept all donations. You can check out our website, though, KUCI.org, to check out some cool premiums that we have. If you pledge $35 or more, you can get everything from concert tickets to a tote bag or a coffee mug or a KUCI t-shirt to sport around. All sorts of things. You can even come on the radio and sit in and do your own show like one of the DJs here. So a lot of things to offer. If you call in, you can find out more about these prizes and get yourself something really cool while supporting this radio station. So I'm very excited today to have my guest, Dr. Kewas, who is going to be talking about a very unique group that she studies. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kewas.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And you're no stranger to radio, as I just learned. So you've been also doing this. Could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about yourself?
My name is Claudia Kewas, and I'm a neurologist who's been interested for now many years in aging and dementia. But before I knew I wanted to be a neurologist, I did a classical radio DJ program at Swarthmore College.
Oh, awesome. Out in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, outside Philadelphia.
Very cool, very cool. And so then you started getting interested in aging, and you decided to focus on that as your medical specialty?
Well, I didn't really know I was interested in aging. I thought I was interested in the brain.
Right.
And eventually that led me first to be a social science major in linguistics and psychology. And at that time I was interested in how children's brain works and learns things. I mean, a two-year-old can learn to speak a language that you or I could spend a lot of years trying to study and never do as well. And that's a pretty amazing thing. Over time, mm-hmm. though, I started realizing the brain is amazing at every age.
Mm-hmm.
And after I became a neurologist and still wasn't sure what I wanted to do, I was offered a job in aging. And my response was, I'm not interested in aging.
So how'd you come around?
I had a very, very wise mentor. Dr. Robert Katzman, who was the chair of the department at Albert Einstein, said to me, well, what are you interested in? And And when I said I didn't know, he said, well, why don't you do this until you find out?
He got you there.
Huh? And I guess I'm still finding out.
Very nice. So you've certainly taken it by the horn since then and followed it up in a very, very interesting and successful career. What we really want to talk about for sure is the 90-plus study that you've been running here from UCI. Along with Dr. Corrada. Could you tell us a little bit about kind of the goals of this study or however you would introduce it to somebody?
Well, I've always been interested in aging, but when I moved to UCI about 15 years ago, I started becoming more and more aware that the fastest growing segment of the entire population in almost all of the world, not just developed countries, but in most of the world, the fastest growing segment is what we refer to as the oldest old. So the oldest old used to be defined as people over the age of 85, but now it's not such a big deal to be over 85, and so we decided to start looking at what it's like to be 90 and 100.
Ah, okay. That is considered the oldest old then, right?
Right now, I'd say most people would consider the oldest old to be those over 90.
Right, yes. Right, certainly. What is the oldest person recorded that who has lived?
The world's record for longevity is held by Madame Jean-Louis Calment, who was born in Arles, France. And my favorite story about her was when she was 90 years old, she made a deal with a 47-year-old man.
Okay.
And the deal she made was that she had a very nice apartment in Paris, and she would stay living in the apartment in Paris, but he would pay her a monthly fee, and when she died, the apartment would be his, and he'd have to pay 10 years worth of monthly fees to cover the market price for the apartment at the time.
So he figured.
He's 47, she's 90. Seems like a good actuarial bet, huh? So he actually paid 10 years, and then he paid 20 years. And then he paid 30 years. And then he died.
Oh, wow.
And his widow had to pay the last few years because Madame Calmet lived to be more than 122.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And although she died more than a decade ago, she continues to hold the world record. Actually, very recently, the oldest person in the world died, and this was a woman who was 116. So not too many people have even come close to Madame Calmet.
She seems incredible. But certainly not many have reached her age, but as you're saying, many are crossing into this 90-plus threshold nowadays.
Oh, in the United States alone, we have more than 2 million people in that age range, but it's going to go to more than 10 million people by the middle of the century, just in the U.S.,
And is this a segment of the population we know much about?
Well, since they're pioneers and they hardly existed before, we absolutely know almost nothing about them. We know very little about how they got to be that way. We know very little about what their health status is like or genes are like or anything. They have a lot to teach us.
Only 100 years ago, I think the average lifespan was, what, something in the 40s?
Exactly.
Something like that.
Exactly. 100 years ago, average life expectancy was probably 49 for women and 47 or less for men.
Right, right. And now people are reaching this level. So tell us, okay, we've set it up. Clearly, we don't know much about this group, but what do we know and how did we come to know it?
Well, I think that, you know, research tells us a lot, and we've learned a lot just even in the last decade, especially. I mean, they're the most rapidly growing segment of the population, and we had one of the only studies with individuals over age 90. But now, throughout much of the world, in fact, we're involved in an international consortium with places in Europe and Australia to put together all of our data, particularly for centenarians, and even what some people now refer to as super centenarians, which are individuals who live beyond 110.
Oh, okay. I see. So it's a global phenomenon to try to study this group.
It is. It is. It's happening throughout the world.
I see. And are these studies usually conducted in a manner where you would try to identify people at earlier in their life and then follow them and hope some of them reach into this level? Or do you look back on people's lives after they've crossed the threshold?
Well, you can do it both ways, and different studies have taken completely different approaches. I wanted to know a lot about individuals before they got to be 100. And I wanted to know it preferably without having to ask them to remember. You know, what were you doing when you were 60? I think for a 100-year-old, that's
a bit challenging.
A bit challenging.
I don't even know what I had for lunch yesterday.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, most people don't.
Yeah.
So we took the approach that in 1981, a 14-page questionnaire was mailed to every single resident in what was then called Leisure World.
Okay.
And this was a 14-page questionnaire about a lot of lifestyle. Mm-hmm. About what people ate, whether or not they exercised, some of their activities, whether or not they were taking vitamin E, whether or not the women were taking estrogen, things like that. So we decided we were going to take those 14,000 people mm-hmm. and 30 years later see how many of them had made it to 90 and beyond mm-hmm. and try to get a handle on if in 1981, for example, you said you were taking vitamin E, mm-hmm. did you live longer than people who were the same age as you at the same time and not mm-hmm. taking vitamin E? Mm-hmm. Or did you live longer if you were exercising? Or mm-hmm. did you have more dementia if you mm-hmm. were taking certain things? We want.
And for folks listening close to home, this community pleasure, what was it?
Leisure World?
Leisure World. Mm-hmm. Leisure World it was closer than we expect, right? Where was this?
So Leisure Worlds are actually a chain. They started here, actually, in Southern California. Mm-hmm. In order to move into a Leisure World community, you need to be over the age of 55. Uh-huh. So it is a senior, but an active senior community.
Right.
So this is not a place that has any kind of nursing homes or any kind of major care. It was for seniors who wanted to get out and do things uh-huh. and all kinds of activities. There are now Leisure Worlds actually throughout the United States in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was in Baltimore, there was one nearby in Maryland that we mm-hmm. also did some research in. But probably one of the largest ones is just about 8 miles south of UCI, and mm-hmm. it's now called Laguna Woods, California.
I see. And it's in Laguna Hills.
And it's right next to Laguna Hills. It's actually its own city, Laguna Woods. In fact, in the 2000 and 2010 census was the, quote, oldest city in the United States. Meaning, even though it's a brand new city, it had the oldest mean age of any place in the United States. Uh-huh. They've had mayors who are 90 years old more than once, and wow. A lot of movers and shakers live there.
Wow. That sounds like such a different reality in some sorts of ways, you know.
It is. The first time I visited, I wanted to move in myself. I mean, it was like camp for kids, you know. They have all these clubhouses, and they have all kinds of classes, and yeah. jewelry making, and they have their own theater group, they have their own newspaper, and they have their own television station and wow. radio station. All sorts of sports activities, including, you know, golf, horseback riding, tennis. It's really quite the place.
That's fascinating. So mm-hmm. a world in and of itself.
It is.
I see. So, okay, tell us. You started with this population when they were in their 60s, when it was called Leisure World. And you've been following it up ever since?
Well, in 1981, the average age of the 14,000 people was actually about 71 or 2 years
71
old.
71 or 2, okay.
With a range of 55 to 100 and some odd, even then.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So what we did was in 2003, January 1st, 2003, if you were one of those people and you were still alive and you were over the age of 90, we wanted you.
I see. So many criteria had to be met.
Absolutely. And it turns out that even though all these 14,000 people lived in Laguna Woods or Leisure World at the time, now they live in 37 states.
Oh, okay. So people had moved out.
Many people had moved out. Mm-hmm. In particular, you know, sometimes they moved to be closer to family or friends, or sometimes they moved out because they needed a nursing home or some other
thing. A community with more resources.
With more support for them. Mm-hmm. So we've gone to 37 states to see them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So my really staff loves going to Hawaii and Puerto Rico.
Is that a common destination?
Not as common as they'd like. They were devastated when the gentleman in Hawaii died.
Oh, I'm sure. So tell us what kinds of... So when did you guys... different people turned... came into the 90 plus group at different points.
They come. They get invited in on their 90th birthday.
On their 90th birthday. So at what point did you guys start to find some results of statistical power, I guess?
Well, we started bringing people in January 1st, 2003. And I mean, power depends on what you're trying to study or what you're looking for. Sure. At this point, we have enrolled over the last decade more than 1,700 people.
1,700.
1,700 people plus have been enrolled in the study. So depending what we wanted to study and how many people we needed, they've accumulated, you know, with a lot of hard work. We've published quite a few papers now and found out a lot of surprising things, actually, especially things that some people wouldn't have predicted.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of this?
Well, I think that we've always make the assumption, and as a physician, I'm guilty of this too, but we do studies in places like Framingham, and we do these studies in people who are maybe in their 50s or 60s or maybe 70s, and we learn a lot of things. And then we just assume that those things are also true for an 80 or a 90 or a 100-year-old. And that doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, we don't assume those same things are true for a 10 or 12-year-old. We understand that age matters and that young people get different diseases. Young people need different treatments. Young people react differently. But we've always acted like people, as they get to the other end of life, are actually just a bad version of a 50 or a 60-year-old. And I think some of what we found is that shows quite the opposite, that in fact they are in a different life epoch, and things that are relevant at one part of your life may or may not be as important at another stage. So, for example, individuals in their 90s who develop high blood pressure actually appear to have a lower risk of dementia than individuals who do not develop high blood pressure.
Oh, wow.
Which most of us wouldn't have predicted. And now we're trying to find out why.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, lowering blood pressure is such a focus of modern medicine in every other age group.
It absolutely is. And every year it becomes more and more tight control that's recommended generally. And we do know that high blood pressure and control of high blood pressure has been important in improving outcomes, particularly stroke and heart attacks and even dementia. But that's so there's no question that if you have high blood pressure in your 50s or 60s or 70s, without treatment, your risk is increased.
Right.
But apparently in your 90s, things are different.
I see. And would you want to have that higher blood pressure at any point before 90 for it to have like a ramping up effect for your
90s? Looks like the protective effect is best when you develop it, the later you develop it.
The later you develop it, I see.
So it appears that people who develop high blood pressure in their 50s and 60s and 70s actually have an increased risk of many things, including dementia. If you develop high blood pressure in your 80s, it looks a little more neutral. And if you develop it in your 90s, that's when it starts looking outright protective.
Wow.
So that individuals who develop it in their 90s actually do better than individuals who never develop hypertension and live past age 90.
That's fascinating. Are there other results that are kind of counterintuitive to the recommendations we make for other age groups?
Well, I think that there have been other surprises. So it turns out that if you have dementia, and by dementia I mean a loss of cognitive abilities of sufficient severity to affect your trying daily to do living. Things in daily living and your job and your home life. So if you have dementia and you die and come to autopsy as a 90-year-old, mm-hmm. about 60% of the time we find significant amounts of Alzheimer's disease in the brain.
Oh, okay.
That's not surprising. That's mm-hmm. probably similar to some extent with what you'd find if you have dementia in your 60s or 70s also, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that if you die in your 90s with good thinking and good memory and no dementia, mm-hmm. you have about a 40% chance of having the same level of Alzheimer's pathology in your brain.
Really?
Without
any
without
phenotype.
Cognitive problems, without the cognitive phenotype. Exactly. It is. When you think about it, if we can understand why a 90-year-old brain can tolerate Alzheimer's pathology, maybe we could figure out how younger people could tolerate it, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is fascinating. So I wanted to ask you in some of the closing minutes. It's just kind of flown by, but this seems like such a wealth of knowledge from the correlations we can draw from this study. Where do we go from here, both scientifically? What leads are the most exciting to follow up? Is it, for example, this one? And how does this maybe influence us as we think about how to live longer lives, but also lives of greater quality?
Well, absolutely. I mean, longevity isn't what most of us want. It's a quality with longevity. And I think that in all science and here, you asked a great question. So what we've been doing so far is what we call an observational study, mm-hmm. where we can get, as you refer to them, correlations. But correlations doesn't mean causation, as everybody knows. And mm-hmm. what we need now is to try to understand why some of these things happen. And then our goal would be to translate this into clinical trials, mm-hmm. where we would try to intervene and improve the outcomes for people as they approach their 90s and 100s. So we've been looking at all sorts of things that we want to consider to see if we can help reduce the risk of dementia as well as frailty, disability, and other things that make people worry about getting old. And it's a work in progress.
Right, of course, mm-hmm. of course. And do we take anything away from us in our own lives right now?
Well, I think people often like our studies about longevity. Uh-huh. So this has nothing to do with what you look like at that age, but it has to do with how many years you live.
Right.
And it turns out that some of our first publications showed that individuals who exercise live longer than individuals who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is 45 minutes a day on average, and it didn't have to be super vigorous, worked.
Uh-huh.
Individuals who did leisure activities that weren't exercise, mm-hmm. that for every hour that you spend is associated with a longer life.
Okay.
Individuals who drank between 200 and 400 milligrams of caffeine a day, whether it be through coffee, tea, cola, or even chocolate, live longer than individuals who had no caffeine or more caffeine than that.
That's good news to a lot.
People. Individuals who gained weight in their 80s and 90s, or mm-hmm. at least maintained their weight, live much longer than individuals who are thin uh-huh. as they age. And finally, individuals who drank alcohol in moderation lived mm-hmm. longer than people who didn't.
Some parting wisdom, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Very nice. So perhaps you could also tell the listeners, if they're interested in finding out more about this or even enrolling in this study, I understand it's possible to begin volunteering. Where should people go?
So this is actually the first year that we're willing to take new volunteers into the study who weren't part of the original cohort. And if you're interested in finding out more information about participation, you can call us at our office in Laguna Woods. And the number is 949-768-3635. That's 949-768-3635.
Perfect. And we can put that number up on the show blog as well. That will be pillsonkuci.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Kewas.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So to remind us again, you've been listening to Pills on KUCI. This has been DJ Broca bringing you stories in medicine. And as you know, this station right now is doing a fun drive for the spring. We hope that this will be the only fun drive that we do for the year. We're currently half at our goal of $10,000. And if you'd come in and donate, we can reach that goal and we won't have to do another one come fall. You can donate by calling in to 949-824-KUCI.